It is 5 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. President Obama speaks out on extremism. Mr. Obama says any contention by terrorist groups that Western nations are fighting a war against Islam is what he calls an ugly lie. In a wide-ranging speech at a White House-sponsored anti-terrorism summit in Washington Thursday, the president rejected the idea that mostly Christian and Jewish Western nations are waging a war on Muslims. Mr. Obama said world leaders must help people escape poverty and oppression, which he said are breeding grounds for terrorist recruitment.
When people are oppressed and human rights are denied, particularly along sectarian lines or ethnic lines, when dissent is silenced, it feeds violent extremism.
President Obama said the world's governments and cultures must look to end sectarian conflicts, including Sunnis against Shiites in the Muslim world. A top U.S. military official says Iraqi and Kurdish fighters plan to launch an operation in April or May to take back the city of Mosul from Islamic State. The official from U.S. Central Command, who spoke under condition of anonymity, says up to 25,000 Iraqi troops will make up the main attack force. Kurdish Peshmerga fighters would contain Islamic State from the north and west of the city. The U.S. has already launched airstrikes on Islamic State supply lines in advance of the mission. Nigeria's military says it carried out airstrikes Thursday, striking Boko Haram bases in the northeast and killing a large number of militants. The military says the Nigerian Air Force targeted Boko Haram training camps and weapons dumps in the Sambisa Forest and the town of Gwoza, two Boko Haram strongholds. There's been no independent confirmation of the military's story. This is VOA News. The World Health Organization says anti-Ebola efforts in West Africa are being undermined by unsafe burials, along with failure to identify dozens of Ebola cases. Health officials have warned for many months that to stop the virus from spreading, suspected Ebola cases must be isolated and tested, and those killed must be buried by workers wearing special protective gear. Qatar recalled its ambassador to Egypt for consultations Thursday in a widening rift over Egyptian airstrikes against Islamic State militants in Libya earlier this week. Qatar expressed concern about Egypt's decision to respond unilaterally. Egypt's delegate to the Arab League says Qatar's objection showed that it is supportive of terrorism. Britain rejected sending international forces to Libya and lifting an arms embargo on the North African nation. It came a day after emergency UN Security Council sessions were held on escalating violence in the country. Hopes for a tattered Ukrainian ceasefire continue to fade. There are reports of fresh fighting near the Ukrainian port city of Mariupol. A Kiev military spokesman says pro-Russian separatists, following a victory over Ukrainian forces at Debaltseve, began heavy shelling of a village on the outskirts of Mariupol on Wednesday. Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko called for UN peacekeepers to monitor the remains of the ceasefire deal announced last week. A new study confirms malaria resistant to the most effective current treatment has spread across Myanmar, also known as Burma. VOA's Steve Herman reports.
Public health specialists are raising alarm because a resistant strain of malaria has reached close to Myanmar's border with India. This has been revealed in a study in a medical journal. Its senior author is Charles Woodrow of the Mahidan Oxford Tropical Medicine Research Unit in Bangkok.
To see the levels of resistant parasites that we do extending that far sort of north and close to the border was to some degree a surprise.
Woodrow says researchers confirmed resistant parasites just 25 kilometers from the Indian border. Researchers fear the parasites will follow the trajectory of previous drug-resistant strains that eventually migrated all the way to Africa, ruining the opportunity to eradicate malaria. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Northeastern Australia's Queensland state is preparing for Cyclone Marcia. Forecasters say Cyclone Marcia is a Category 5 storm, the most dangerous. The worst of the storm is expected to strike near the town of Yeppoon with massive waves, heavy rain and winds, about 290 kilometers per hour. Local police are already saying the storm will be a calamity and have urged people to seek shelter in evacuation centers. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Bate in Washington. Today is Friday, February 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Nigeria's Elections Commission will use electronic card reader to counter vote rigging in the March 28 election.
The only thing it does is to accredit and authenticate the voter and then verify the voter as the genuine owner of the permanent voter card that we are using for the election.
Nick Dazan is the Deputy Director for Public Affairs of Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission. A spokesman for Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza says the president has not decided to seek a third term. And Malawi's parliament passes a bill that sets the legal age of marriage for girls from 15 to 18 years. But some say 18 is too young to marry.
In fact, as chiefs, we are advocating for 21 years. Why? Because we thought 21 years would be more ideal. The girl child would have grown well. And by the time she's 21, she should have finished her Form 4. So we are looking along those lines.
That's traditional authority Chowe of Malawi's southern district of Mangochi. And U.S. President Barack Obama calls for governments to unite against violent extremism. The stories plus Mark Oldman's Sports and our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A senior official of Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission, known as INEC, has refuted reports that the use of card readers to authenticate voters is unconstitutional. Both the 1999 Constitution and the Electoral Act of 2010 stipulate that electronic voting is prohibited, at least for now. Critics say those laws are almost meant to cover the use of electronic readers to check voter registration cards. But Nick Dazan, Deputy Director for Public Affairs of the Electoral Commission, tells reporter Peter Clotty that the critics are misunderstanding the measures.
The card reader we are deploying for the elections is meant only for accrediting voters before they vote. Electronic voting means using a machine to vote. And in the instance of the card reader, the only thing it does is to accredit and authenticate the voter and then verify the voter as the genuine owner of the permanent voter card that we are using for the election. So it is not correct to say that the card reader is in breach of any law. Besides, the INEC chairman yesterday before the Senate cited several sections of the Constitution and the Electoral Act to buttress the fact that the card reader was not only legal but on solid legal ground.
Critics of the card reader are saying that interpreting the exact electoral law basically prevent the Electoral Commission or INEC from deploying card readers in the election, and they think that could undermine the credibility of the vote. Specifically, do you think their criticisms are justified?
The criticisms are unfounded and they are not justified. And if anything, what the card reader seeks to do is to enhance the credibility and integrity of the process. In time past, the voter register was not only padded. People rigged elections at the point of voting. What the card reader seeks to do is to stop people from rigging and to ensure that only the genuine and valid owners of the permanent voter cards that we issue out are allowed to vote.
Are your ad hoc officials or ad hoc staff, are they adequately and competently trained to handle this card reading machine during election period?
I will say yes, because all the ad hoc staff we are deploying for these elections are core members, people who graduated from the universities, and we are also using students from tertiary institutions at the highest level. These are highly literate staff, and we put them through rigorous training so that we do not face any embarrassment on the day of election.
Nick Dazang is the Deputy Director for Public Affairs for Nigeria's Independent National Electoral Commission. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Abuja. A spokesman for Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza said the opposition is afraid of the president's popularity, and as such, they keep second-guessing him whether he's going to seek a third term or not. Deputy Presidential Spokesman Abayeho Gervais said Mr. Nkurunziza will stand for a third term in the June election if he is chosen by his ruling CNDD-FDD party. Opposition leader Agathon Rwasa told VOA recently that President Nkurunziza should take advantage of all the privileges guaranteed him under the Constitution by leaving power peacefully and not trying to change the Constitution for a third term. Gervais said the opposition should work to defeat the ruling party and not an individual.
In the CNDD-FDD party, an individual does not decide by himself that he's standing on his party's ticket. There must be a Congress which will put his name forward that he represents the party. This Congress has not taken place. I think the world must be patient. It is only a few months away, if not a few days away. This Congress will take place and the world will know the truth.
When the comparison was made to other countries that are having trouble, where the presidents are trying to change the constitution and there's protest, the spokesman said whoever calls on people to take to the streets will be considered troublemakers and will be treated as such. That's a threat to your citizens.
Which other countries are you talking about? Burundi is Burundi. Burundi should not be taken as any other country. You are talking about countries that have changed the constitution. Burundi has not changed its constitution. A bill was tabled in the parliament for this to happen, and the vote in the parliament could not allow this move to happen. So there has not been any change in the constitution in this country, which you are talking about.
I spoke with the opposition leader, Agathon Rwasa, and he said it would be wise for President Nkurunziza to take advantage of all the privileges guaranteed him under the constitution if he had to leave power peacefully. He said it wouldn't be wise if your security forces use violence against citizens who might want to protest any decision the president makes.
I think the opposition are afraid of this person because they know how popular he is. They know that he's somebody who has steered this country out of war, out of conflict, out of ethnic division, out of all the problems we had in the past. In actual fact, the opposition should not have any problem with an individual. They should have a problem with the party. They should set up mechanisms, strategies to defeat the party, not the individual.
The Burundi constitution allows for only two terms. Is it true that the president, President Nkurunziza, is arguing that he has not been able to serve two terms? He has only served one term, and the first term was that he was selected. Is that his argument?
There are two things in the Arusha Accord and in the constitution whereby they set the term limit to two. And then there is another section of this fundamental text where it is said that the president must be elected by the people. Now, in the first term, His Excellency the President was elected by the parliament. He was only chosen by the people only once. That is where lawmakers will try to look into this and explain to the world whether the president is allowed to stand or not. And as far as I'm concerned, it is up to lawyers to tell us whether Nkurunziza can indeed stand or not.
Abayeho Gervais is the deputy spokesman for Burundian President Pierre Nkurunziza. He was speaking with me from the capital, Bujumbura. Dedimus Mutasa, Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party's former secretary for administration, had become a permanent fixture in the organization. But earlier this week, things changed when he was expelled from the ranks of a party that he has belonged to for almost his whole life. ZANU-PF spokesman Simon Kaya Moyo said Mutasa and another member of parliament were expelled for insubordination. But Mutasa, in this exclusive interview with VOA Zimbabwe service, says he does not recognize the expulsion.
I am not a part of that organization. I remained in the original ZANU-PF where they don't belong. And they cannot expel me from that organization, which they have gotten out of. So I am asking, which organization did they expel me from? And because they belong to the other organization, I'm contending that they did not expel me at all. I'm still a member of the original ZANU-PF, and that's it.
And about this alleged expulsion, have you received any communication from your other colleagues?
Nobody has ever written to me to say that. They were wanting to put me through a disciplinary committee. All that we understood from the newspapers, no one of them wrote to say I was to be subjected to that disciplinary committee. We gathered through the press that they were waiting the arrival back into the country of the First Lady. They never intimated to me that view. And so we are living in a country of guessing what our leadership wants to do. And so we find that a little bit worrying.
That was former ZANU-PF Secretary for Administration Didemus Mutasa speaking from Harare with reporter Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe Service. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, February 20th. Still to come, Mark Oldman's post in our Black History Month and African History Facts of the Day. Please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time, 16 minutes past the hour. Malawi's parliament has passed a revised marriage bill, raising the legal age of marriage for girls from 15 to 18. The revision comes after years of controversy. But as Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre, it is not over yet.
The Marriage, Divorce and Family Relations Bill, which was passed last week, seeks to replace a widely criticized old law which allowed 15-year-old girls to marry with parental consent. First drafted in 2006, the bill has gone several changes to differentiate it from the old law, which last campaigners said contributed to a high number of school dropouts and early marriages among girls. Lawmaker Jessica Bwira is also spokesperson for the leading opposition party in parliament, the Malawi Congress Party.
This bill illustrates aims to fight a problem that is at the root of high rates of school dropout, rates fistula, high mortality rate, poverty, HIV and AIDS, and other forms of abusive and oppressive products of attendant to girls getting married early.
Under the new law, anyone marrying a girl younger than 18 will serve a minimum jail term of 10 years. Traditional leaders are unhappy with the new law. They say the legal age for marriage should be higher. Many have established laws in their own districts, setting the minimum marriage age for a girl at 21. Traditional authority Kashindamoto told VOA that 18 is still too early for a Malawian girl to marry because at this age she's still in secondary school. She said the chiefs will push for further amendments to the law. Traditional authority Chowe of Malawi Southern District of Mangochi agrees.
In fact, as chiefs, we're advocating for 21 years. Why? Because we thought 21 years would be more ideal. The girl child would have grown well. And by the time she's 21, she should have finished her Form 4. So we're looking along those lines.
Girls themselves are also divided on the bill. Sharifa Sain told VOA that 18 is an appropriate year for a girl to get married because this is the time a girl can fully enjoy marriage and also a way of avoiding all sorts of temptations that befall adolescents. But Wainess Kibogoyo, a journalism student at Malawi Institute for Journalism, disagrees.
I'm not in support of that because at the age of 18, most of the girls are young and they can't able to make decisions. But I think if they can put the age of 21, like the chiefs are saying, it can be much better because they can able to decide and think of what they can do in life.
Legal experts say the parliament rushed in passing the amended bill before changing the constitutional provision that stipulates young people between 15 and 18 may marry upon parental consent. Mwiza Nkata is the Dean of Law at the Chancellor College of the University of Malawi.
If parliament wished to change the marriage age in the country, what they needed to do was to amend Section 22 of the Constitution, not just pass a separate legislation then try to change the age by that. As it is, there is a contradiction between the marriage age as set in the bill and the marriage age as set in the Constitution.
Some commentators are asking President Peter Mutharika not to sign off on the new bill until the Malawi Constitution is revised. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
U.S. President Barack Obama is urging governments to take action to bring an end to violent extremism and conditions that lead to it. The president spoke to foreign ministers from around the world in Washington as part of the White House summit to counter violent extremism. VOA's Mary Alice Salinas reports from the State Department.
President Barack Obama continued a three-day summit on Thursday where he called on leaders from 60 countries from around the world to join the fight against violent extremism.
It's not a question of Jews or Christians or Muslims. We're all in the same boat, and we have to help each other to get out of this crisis.
After 2 days of sessions that focused on empowering communities to combat extremist ideologies and recruitment, the U.S. leader urged nations to address conditions that fuel terrorism and violent extremism.
Nations need to break the cycles of conflict, especially sectarian conflict, that have become magnets for violent extremism. We must address the grievances that terrorists exploit, including economic grievances.
Jordan's foreign affairs minister, Nasser Judeh, called on governments to reach out especially to young people who are often the target of recruitment efforts by terrorists.
It is all about education, education, education. Opportunity, opportunity, opportunity. Empowerment, empowerment, empowerment.
Jordan ramped up its battle against Islamic State militants after the group captured and burned alive a Jordanian pilot. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon urged governments to respect human rights as they strive to combat the threat.
Many years of our experience have proven that short-sighted policies, failed leadership, and an utter disregard for human dignity and human rights have caused tremendous frustration and anger on the part of a people for whom we serve. We will never find our ways by discarding our moral compass.
President Obama called on governments to address legitimate grievances in areas where terrorism and violent extremism are thriving.
When people are oppressed and human rights are denied, particularly along sectarian lines or ethnic lines, when dissent is silenced, it feeds violent extremism. It creates an environment that is ripe for terrorists to exploit. When peaceful democratic change is impossible, it feeds into the terrorist propaganda that violence is the only answer available.
U.S. officials say the goal of the gathering is to come up with strategies based on facts and realities that nations can implement together to end violent extremism. More regional meetings are expected in coming months, and U.S. officials say there will be a broader discussion on progress in the fight against extremism at the upcoming United Nations General Assembly session in September. Mary Alice Salinas, VOA News, the State Department.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Mark Owuma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Friday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our latest after sports news, we begin with athletics. Ethiopian Genzebe Dibaba set a women's world indoor 1,000-meter record of 14 minutes and 18.86 seconds at the IAAF Indoor Grand Prix meet in Stockholm, Sweden, on Thursday night. The previous record, also held by an Ethiopian, was 14 minutes 24.23 seconds by Meseret Defar in 2009. Meanwhile, Kenyans Bethuel Birgen, Collins Chebi, and Silas Kiplagat were second, third, and fourth, respectively, in the men's 1,500 meters. Turning to football, defending champions Ivory Coast edged the Cameroon 2-1 as Mali and South Africa drew 2-2 in Group B action at the Orange African Under-17 Championships in Niamey, Niger, on Thursday. After two matches each, Ivory Coast and Mali have 4 points, while South Africa has two, as Cameroon have no points. Tomorrow, Saturday, in Group A action, Niger playing Guinea as Zambia challenge Nigeria. On Sunday, Ivory Coast play Mali as South Africa face Cameroon. Meanwhile, Nigeria's under-20 side beat their Ghanaian host and peers 2-0 in a friendly match played in Tema. The two sides drew 2-2 in an earlier encounter in Accra. Both teams are preparing for the Orange Africa under-20 championships in Senegal next month.
Elsewhere, Algerian Orange Africa Champions League title holder Ventensatif hosts the Egypt's Orange Africa Confederations Cup champions El Ahly in the Orange Africa Super Cup in Blida, some 50 kilometers southwest of the capital Algiers, tomorrow, Saturday. Meanwhile, Tanzania hosts Kenya in the return leg of the Africa Beach Soccer Championship qualifiers in Dar es Salaam tomorrow, Saturday. Tanzania won 4-2 in the opening round, while Mozambique welcomed Mauritius in Maputo on Sunday. Mauritius prevailed 4-2 in the opening leg. Sudan will play Djibouti in a one-off qualifier in Cairo, Egypt. Finally, in cricket, Zimbabwe beat the United Arab Emirates by 4 wickets at the ICC Cricket World Cup in Nelson, New Zealand on Thursday. On Sunday, South Africa play India in Melbourne, Australia. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa, wishing you all a sporty weekend. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. It's time now for our Black History Month and African History Facts for today, February 20th. On this day in 1927, Sidney Poitier was born in Miami, Florida. He became the first African-American to win an Academy Award for his role in the movie Lilies of the Field. Poitier was also the first black to play a leading role in an American movie without reference to his race. Also today in 1895, Frederick Douglass, African-American spokesman and abolitionist, died in Anacostia Heights, District of Columbia. He was 78 years old. Douglass was born a slave in the state of Maryland on February 14, 1817. On this day in 1963, retired NBA player Charles Wade Barkley was born in Leeds, Alabama. In 1993, Barkley was voted the NBA's most valuable player, and during the NBA's 50th anniversary, named one of the 50 greatest players in NBA history. Since retiring from the NBA, Barkley has become a successful color commentator on basketball for the U.S. television network TNT. Did you know that Granville T. Woods was a 19th century inventor known as the Black Thomas Edison for his electrical engineering? In 1887, Woods developed a device he called synchronous multiplex railway telegraph. The device not only helped dispatchers locate trains, it also allowed moving trains to communicate by telegraph. On this day in African history, in 1920, Egyptian Christian Coptic Prime Minister Boutros Ghali was assassinated by Islamic nationalist fanatics who accused him of supporting the British. His grandson, Boutros Ghali, who was named after him, would go on to become the Deputy Prime Minister of Egypt and Secretary General of the United Nations. Also, on this day in African history, in 1951, the first parliament was opened in the British colony of Gold Coast, known today as Ghana, as part of the long process towards self-determination. 2 weeks after, Ghana became an independent nation on March 6, 1957. Congratulations to Asindu Robert of Arua, West Nile, Uganda, James K. Sibley of Swakoko in Bon County, Liberia, and Dele Oyewole of the University of Ilori in Kwara State, Nigeria. You are the winners of our February 19th question, who is the first African-American student to enroll at the all-white University of Mississippi in 1962? The answer, James H. Meredith. Now, here is our question for today, February 20th. Who were the Tuskegee Airmen? Once again, who were the Tuskegee Airmen? Send your answers to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Remember to include your mailing address. That's it for this Friday, February 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Bate in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very good weekend.
Celebrate the sounds of Africa today, yesterday, and tomorrow. That's our mission in your show, Music Time in Africa. Hello, I'm your host, Heather Maxwell. Join me every Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC and discover the best Pan-African music in the world. We play it all right here. Only the best on VOA Africa.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz and 15580 kilohertz. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.